Today on Against the Grain, he was a trailblazing critic of imperialism, but chances are you've never heard of him. The radical Japanese journalist Kotoku Shisui, who moved from socialism to anarchism, wrote a seminal critique of imperialism before Hobson and Lenin and led the movement against empire in Japan. I'm Sasha Lilly. Robert Tierney will discuss with me Kotoku's life, his classic work Imperialism, and his times. That's coming right up. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. The turn of the last century was an age of empire, with great powers dividing up the world between them. Out of that period came some of the most influential writings about imperialism, most notably by J.A. Hobson and Vladimir Lenin, which still inform the left's understanding of imperialism today. But one classic work, which predates both Hobson and Lenin, is virtually unknown in the West, partially because it was not translated into English until now, and partially because its target was a non-Western empire, Japan. The book, titled Imperialism, was written by the radical Japanese journalist Kotoku Shisui, who was born in 1871 and was executed by the Japanese state in 1911. Today, to discuss the life, ideas, and times of Kotoku, I'm pleased to be joined by Robert Tierney, who has made for the first time Kotoku's work available in English. His translation of Imperialism is included in Tierney's book, Monster of the 20th Century, Kotoku Shisui and Japan's First Anti-Imperialist Movement, which is published by the University of California Press. Tierney is Associate Professor and Head of East Asian Languages and Cultures, Comparative and World Literatures at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Bob, can you start by situating Japan in the late 19th century as an imperial power? What kind of society was it, and what were its state's ambitions?
I think that's key to understanding, a figure like Kotoku Shisui. I think Japan occupied a paradoxical position as being a country that was sort of escaped from colonization, but it was actually threatened by colonization, and then in a short time, it became a colonizer. So basically, Japan, when it is forced to open up because of the gunboat diplomacy of the United States in 1853, it very quickly decides to reform and westernize its institutions. And it discovers at that time that to be respected by other powers, it needs to become an empire. And I think that that becomes a kind of emulation of Western imperialist powers is one of the key motivations for Japan to become an empire. And so in a fairly short time, starting with its defeat of China in the Sino-Japanese War, which is like 1895, and then its defeat of Russia in the Russo-Japanese War, which is 10 years later, Japan emerges with colonies such as Taiwan and Korea, and then it continues to grow and expand in the first half of the 20th century until 1945, which puts an end to the Japanese Empire.
And what was the state of movements in Japan in, let's just start with the late 19th century, as some of this really deep reshaping of Japanese society and orientation to the rest of the world was changing? What was the state of movements that might take on an anti-imperialist character in Japan?
Yeah, I think partly because Japan's feared being colonized by Western powers, there was a very strong impetus early in the Meiji period, which begins in 1868, for Japan to unite with other Asian countries in resisting Western influence. So this becomes a very, very important idea, an important movement. And it's something that happens early in the period. Now, this movement is also later sort of shaped by what's called Pan-Asianism, which is the belief that Japan should lead the rest of Asia because Japan was the first country to modernize. So it gets sort of co-opted by you know, the imperialism in Japan. But I think at least initially, it can be thought of as a kind of anti-imperialist movement. And this is one of the tricky things about the Japanese anti-imperialist movement, that it's calling for a unification with the rest of Asia, and at the same time, imperialists are saying that Japan needs to modernize the rest of Asia. So they're in many ways using the same idiom to tell what they're doing. But I think the other thing that's going on in Japan is that the growth of capitalism in Japanese society, which happens very, very quickly in the 1880s, 1890s, and very quickly there are anti-capitalist movements that are created. And because of that, I think, you have early labor movements, you have movements of Christians in Japanese society, and then people like Koto Kujisui who start reading socialists, Western socialists, and anarchists. And so this influx of kind of Western ideas has a very strong impact on Japan and sort of a fertilizing movement on the radical movements in Japanese society that will later take the form of socialism, anarchism, and pacifism.
Okay, so taking those, then separating those out, we'll talk in a moment about those who were involved in the emerging radical anti-capitalist movements of the late 19th century, but the Pan-Asian and anti-imperialist, i.e. anti-Western imperialist movements or orientations, what sort of people were part of those, and where would you situate that, if you could, within the spectrum of left and right, or does that not apply here?
I think it is rather difficult to situate it in a left-right political axis because, first of all, you have people that maybe start out as oppositional figures, and particularly in favor of more democracy in Japan, who later become very, very strong nationalists. And this is something that happens, let's say, over a period of 10 to 20 years, where you see these kind of radical conversions from kind of pro-democratic pacifist ideals to a kind of imperialist nationalism, and particularly favoring expansionism. So it's very difficult to situate the people, but I'm dealing with a lot of people broadly understood. There's a movement not too long after the emperor returns to the center of power in Japan with the Emperor Meiji, there is a pro-democracy movement, a movement in favor of representing the citizens of Japan, and particularly because the government is dominated by two of the feudal clans that led the Meiji Restoration. And so other clans that are left out of power become active in this. Many people, journalists, young educated people such as Koto Kushisui, become drawn to this. And it's out of this and what sort of happens with this movement that we see eventually an anti-imperialist movement develop. But I think this happens in stages. I mean, Koto Kushisui is born after the Meiji period, and so he's not one of the people that actually lives through that experience of a revolution in his society. In fact, he sort of lives after, I guess you'd call it a failed revolution, that this is supposed to be a complete transformation of feudal Japan, but in fact it keeps a despotic government, it promotes even worse inequality. So there's an immense disillusionment that comes out of this, and I think that is what gives birth to this democracy movement.
Well, tell us about Kotoku's origins. What world does he come out of? What forms him in his early years?
Yes, he was born in Kochi Prefecture today. At the time, that was referred to as Tosa. That was the domain name during the earlier period of Japanese history. But Kochi is on the smallest of the Japanese islands, Shikoku. It's a fairly small and marginal prefecture today. But at this time, it was sort of the heart of the oppositional movement to the government. And he's born into a not a poor family, but a family. He loses his father very early in life, and because of that, he's brought up by his mother, and she really has to struggle to survive. So he does not, he goes to school for a few years, but then he's unable to continue his education in the middle school. At that time, they only had compulsory education really up to grade six. And what he ends up doing is gravitating toward this big figure of the opposition movement, Nakai Chomin, an intellectual and one of the leaders of the democracy movement in Japan. And he becomes basically a houseboy. He lives with him and studies with him for a number of years. And it's under him that he sort of takes on, you know, he reads things like Rousseau. He reads the Chinese classics, and he gets an education. So he becomes the disciple of this, not so much, it's not a formal education, but it's more like, I guess, should think of these as a kind of an associative movement in which you go apprenticing yourself to someone, which was the traditional way of education in Japan.
So then how does he end up embracing what socialist ideas, and in what context did they emerge in Japan? How much were they homegrown? How much did they come in from elsewhere? And to what degree was it a hybrid?
Well, the first thing that he does is, and this is partly through his teacher, he becomes a journalist. So he, after his education, he works for a couple of different journals, some of them associated with the democracy movement, and then eventually with a major journal in Tokyo. It's called the Yorozu Chōhō. It was a very popular journal at that time with a large number of readers. And he becomes an important sort of public intellectual. At this time, which is really we're talking about like the late 1890s, this is when he's found his voice and he's a public intellectual. He takes part in different sort of socialist study groups. There's groups that are formed actually at the Unitarian Church in Tokyo, and they meet to talk about socialist thought. They read different writers, not simply Karl Marx, but Fourier, Saint-Simon, really everything that's being written at this time. And they discuss
and are
that.
These things being translated into Japanese?
Some of them have already been translated into Japanese, but actually most of them haven't. And one of the things that he does later is he translates Kropotkin, he translates Marx, the Communist Manifesto, into Japanese. The first translation that appears is by him, has an immense influence in Japan and also in China, because the words that he uses even to describe bourgeoisie and proletarian have an influent impact on the language that's going to be used in Chinese because of the similarities of the languages. I think they're probably reading most of the things in English at this point, although there are a few things that are translated. There's been a few public intellectuals who were interested in European socialism, but there's very little knowledge about socialism at this time in Japan. It's kind of a new idea. At the same time, it's something that is, I mean, probably the dominant group of socialists in Japan would be people associated with Christianity, and they are interested in, helping the poor and getting people to, for example, set up unions or food cooperatives to help people that are really struggling in Japanese society. And I think that's the situation. When I talk about early manufacturing, I mean, most of the early workers in the Japanese industry were actually women who came to work in the textile factories, and they worked under the most horrible conditions. Whether you look at the hours they worked, they were basically sold into slavery, and many of them end up catching tuberculosis and dying after that. So this concern with the dispossessed and the, the downtrodden in Japanese society is something that I think comes out of a strong Christian impact on Japan. But it in the case of Kotoku Shusui, he was not Christian. He was sort of anti-Christian. And so I think it spreads in other directions.
That is the voice of Robert Tierney. We're talking about his book, which discusses the Japanese radical journalist Kotoku Shusui, who wrote a groundbreaking work in 1901 about imperialism, one of the first general critiques of imperialism written anywhere. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, and I'm Sasha Lilly. So let's talk about what led up to the publication in 1901 of Imperialism. How did he go from being a radical engaged journalist to someone who really is a crucial figure in thinking about imperialism and opposing imperialism in Japan?
Yeah, I think this is something really interesting, and I think this goes to the crux of my research in the book, is that Japan really becomes an imperialist power from 1895, when it acquires the colony of Taiwan. And so that from that point, Japan is an empire. It has colonies. There are a few people that oppose that war. But there's no active oppositional movement to the war. There's no journals that set out to attack the government for launching this war. And there's no real critique of imperialism. On the other hand, I think the catalyzing event is the Boxer Rebellion in China, a movement, a sort of popular movement by sort of martial arts enthusiasts to kick imperialists out of China. And this, they attack missionaries, they kill missionaries, and this results in an immense sort of intervention in China by Western powers, in which Japan, for the first time, takes part as one of the members of the Western imperialist group. And at that time, I think Kotoku Shusui writes many articles about the Boxer Rebellion. And I think for the first time, he sort of sees Japan as being part of not of the Asia that has been colonized, but of the Western imperialist powers that are trying to subject the rest of Asia to colonization. And I think it's from this point that he becomes one of the thinkers of anti-imperialism in Japan. Now, I don't think he has read some things in English, some critiques of imperialism. And I noticed that one of the important sources for him was not actually Hobson, who becomes one of the most important critics of imperialism in England later, but actually wrote after Kotoku Shusui. But this earlier guy, John Robinson, who wrote a book called Patriotism and Empire. And John Robinson basically argues that it's sort of imperialism is a kind of exacerbated type of patriotism in which sort of the energies of downtrodden people, of the masses, are diverted against other peoples and therefore leading to wars of subjugation and imperialism. So I think this argument has a big impact on Kotoku Shusui, who relates it to Japan's imperialism. And he goes on to write his book. First of all, he publishes it in a newspaper. It's serialized, and then he publishes it as a volume in 1901. And as I said, this is before Hobson and some of the other really, really famous critiques of imperialism that were, had the big impact later on Lenin and other thinkers.
To some degree, it seems a bit unfair to contrast his work against theirs since theirs came later. But just for clarity, I wonder if you could talk about the key arguments of Hobson and Lenin's works and contrast them to Kotoku's, because Hobson wrote his book, Imperialism, a Study, 1902. So it was published a year after Imperialism, the Monster of the 20th Century, Kotoku's book. And then Lenin's came actually quite a bit later, Imperialism, the Highest Stage of Capitalism, in 1916. Both of those works focus primarily on the economic motives of empire. So in the case of Hobson, it was to do with a kind of underconsumptionist theory that states need to go elsewhere to find new markets and colonize the rest of the world in search of new markets, whereas Lenin's had to do with a stagist theory to do with capitalist development and the concentration of industry and then a kind of dividing up of the world based on that. How do you contrast Kotoku's basic argument to those which would be more familiar to an audience in the United States?
I think that the big difference is, Harbson and Lenin both really are looking at the most advanced European powers, England, Germany, and their data is almost entirely related to that. Particularly Hobson is writing during the Boer War, and what he's arguing is that these a top group of investors, industrialists, sort of billionaires, is leading the government to conquer South Africa in order to benefit a very small group of society. And so there's, in other words, imperialism is caused by a kind of excess of capital, which is looking for an outlet overseas. And so this argument is then later used to suggest that the imperial powers put most of their investments into their colonies, and that this was a way for them to sort of dispose of excess capital. I think rather than putting their money into improving the problems in domestic society, like, for example, solving problems of poverty, poor health, and other things. So this was the argument that Hobson made, and then later in Lenin, we have the period of World War I, we have the sort of the collapse of empires. What he argues is that this is the highest state, and that the highest state of capitalism is imperialism, a kind of union of financial and industrial power, which has now resulted in countries fighting over the rest of the world, leading to world war. That's sort of in the gist what Lenin's argument, and it really comes out of Hobson, and he refers to Hobson over and over in his study. I think the difference is Kotok Shusui really doesn't make an economic determinist argument. And in fact, it would be very difficult to do that in Japan, because Japan didn't have an excess of capital. It was not exporting capital overseas. It was more politically driven kind of movement to expand that was based on the appeal of ideology, and particularly that of patriotism, that was something that was established really through the new schools, through the conscription system. And the idea was to create an external enemy that would unify the population against an external threat. And this is, it's a kind of psychological, political argument for the causation of imperialism that I think is very different from that of Hobson and Lenin.
In a sense, it seems like these different arguments get to an unresolved contradiction within a lot of these arguments, which is that the export of finance capital around the world, perhaps the exploitation of workers around the world, is also lumped together with territorial expansion, that they both are called imperialism.
Right.
And in fact, they may have different dynamics going on, but there's been a tendency to talk about them as one.
Yeah, and I think that one of the things about imperialism, when we think of it, even within the British Empire, there's differences in the period that Britain colonized countries like Ireland or, let's say, South Africa. And its motivations for doing so probably varied from one period to another. So even looking within one empire, we can see the complexity of this issue. And I think in Japan's case, I think maybe if we turn this into more the timeline of Japanese imperialism, at first, the motivation for Japan to expand is more strategic or political. in the way that Kotoku Shusui argued. But later on, as Japan emerges as the major capitalist country in Asia, Japan also has enormous economic interests in China and particularly in Northeast Asia, but later throughout all of Asia. And that's why it continues to expand, and not simply by asserting political control, but by creating autarctic spaces such as Manchuria, or controlling, the textile industry in cities like Shanghai. So it's not simply a political control of the territories, but a more directly imperialist, economic imperialist control of different parts of China. So Japan, not until it launches a war with China, it does not actually rule China as a colony, the way it rules Korea and Taiwan, but it has an informal empire, which is more similar to that of Western powers in China.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly, and today we're discussing the Japanese radical journalist Kotoku Shusui, who was born in 1871, executed by the Japanese state in 1911, and wrote a groundbreaking study of imperialism in 1901. And the translation of that is included in my guest's book, Monster of the 20th Century, Kotoku Shusui and Japan's First Anti-Imperialist Movement. And that's published by the University of California Press. You can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. And I should mention that Robert Tierney is also the author of Tropics of Savagery, The Culture of Japanese Empire in Comparative Frame. So when this book then came out, published in 1901, what was the impact of it within Japan and Asia more broadly? It was translated a year later into Chinese.
Yeah, that's very interesting. It was translated very quickly into Chinese. And, it's actually never been translated into English until I decided I wanted to translate it. So, and I'm sure the reason was that... First of all, there's a similarity in the languages of Chinese and Japanese. And also, there was an attempt by Chinese intellectuals to learn from Japan, particularly at this time. And so a lot of ideas that become popular in Japan sort of pass through China through networks of students and other intellectuals that are trying to learn about new things. So, but this book has an interesting history. It's published several times after he first publishes it in 1901. It's republished at new editions. And by the third time, it appears there's about 20 newspaper editorials that are also put in an appendix at the end of the book. And it actually creates this debate about imperialism in Japanese society, which has started maybe a few years before the book appears, but it sort of fans the flames of this debate and involves many, many more people. So there's an increasing awareness of imperialism. Previously to this book, imperialism was seen as a Western thing, but this book, I think, quite clearly includes Japan among the imperialist powers, and it is a warning to the Japanese about, at the end of the book, he talks about imperialism as a kind of disease, and that the Japanese need to, the good people of Japan, the intellectuals of Japan, need to become doctors that will cure Japan of this disease. So this is how he sees his role as a kind of doctor ministering to the illnesses of his society. Now, later on, And this is the really interesting part of the story. This could have been just one book that raised an interesting issue. Kotoku Shusui becomes the central figure in an organized movement against the war with Russia. And this is, I think this is the most important aspect of the movement that he creates, that he starts a pacifist newspaper that publishes for about a year in the middle of the war, that he becomes the intellectual leader of a movement, as well as creating the first kind of oppositional press or alternative press in Japanese society. And later on, after 1945, when Japan loses the war, he's seen as one of the first figures of Japanese pacifism, which becomes such an important idea after World War II.
So you mentioned that, in a sense, Kotoku's arguments intersected with the outbreak of this instance of war. This is the Russo-Japanese War of 1904 to 1905, and brought these ideas very much to life in terms of debating what was going on and a movement that was building against imperialism in Japan. What was the scope of the debate in Japan around imperialism? You said that in many ways he sort of set off, gave people a basis on which to debate imperialism. So how was Japanese imperialism debated within the Japanese left?
Yeah, I think...
And beyond, I should say.
I think one of the things that this book does, because shortly after writing this book, he establishes the first Japanese Socialist Party. And since I mentioned the idea that he saw his role as that of the doctor who's freeing Japan from this terrible plague of imperialism, and the prescribed cure actually was to create socialism in Japan, and he saw that as the only way of ending the Japanese imperialism. So later on, he writes a study of socialism called The Essence of Socialism, and this has a very broad impact among Japanese thinkers, among students, and we see the formation of groups. At the same time, though, as a political movement, it's very, very short-lived. Not long after the Socialist Party is created in Japan, it is prohibited. I think even the same day that it releases a kind of manifesto, the government prohibits the Socialist Party. So the government is very paranoid about even the word socialism. And this is something that continues until the end of his life, when he's sort of framed as a terrorist or a leader of a terrorist movement toward the end of his life. And I'll talk about that later. But I think what he does is he establishes this idea not only of imperialism as something that Japan should not do, but the alternative to this is organizing society on a different basis. And he describes this in his book, Socialism. Now, this becomes just an intellectual movement, but it creates a ferment in Japanese society. There's a lot of writers at this time that are drawn to this. It's a very appealing vision of Japanese society as an alternative to the suffering that's caused by both imperialism in Asia and the growth of a capitalist economy in Japan. So there is a kind of diffuse movement in Japanese society, and there are people writing novels, for example, attacking war or attacking the poverty in Japanese society. There's a growing consciousness about this. Studies are being done of the slums in Japanese cities for the first time, right around this time. So this is, it's a period of big change, but it does not really coalesce until you have this major war. And I think, you know, in some ways, like the Iraq War in the United States, I think it brought together a lot of things and a movement to oppose war in not only in this country, but in other countries as well. I think this Russo-Japanese War, because it was a huge war, it was strategically very important, and the government made it sort of a centerpiece of its policy, so that to oppose the government on this war was to really, it really required some bravery, because this was something that they were not willing to compromise on. So, but nevertheless, Kotoku Shusui establishes this newspaper, and throughout all of Japan, there are associations that are created, which are associated with the movement of the newspaper. It's called the Heimin newspaper. Heimin is a word that means kind of a commoner, the commoner's newspaper. But there's an organization called the Heimin Sha, an association of commoners. And this is, it's not centralized organization, but kind of a decentralized movement that occurs throughout Japanese society. And each of the local groupings has its own key issues. They're inviting speakers, they're organizing public meetings, they're organizing protests about the war. So this becomes a very big movement. And the organ for the movement is the newspaper, which includes lots of sort of talk, dialogue between readers and editors of the newspaper. And this newspaper goes on to publish, among other things, Marx's Communist Manifesto, a letter from Tolstoy opposing the war on Christian grounds. It publishes major, major works of writing, as well as taking a consistent stance against the war and in favor of socialism. I think from this time, you have a serious movement in Japanese society. And in spite of the government's efforts to put this movement down, it's a movement that continues, certainly till the end of his life. And then after a period of, after a period of intense repression of socialism, it's reborn in the late, 1918, when you have another movement for democracy in Japanese society. So I think that's the significance of this, that he as a leader of an anti-imperialist, it's partly his ideas about imperialism, but it's also his role as being the central leader for this movement and his role as creating an alternative press in Japan that leads to a fairly big anti-imperialist movement in Japanese society.
You mentioned groups during the Russo-Japanese War reading Tolstoy, and I wonder if in the course of the war, someone like Kotoku and others became closer in some ways to their equivalents in Russia, which of course was also an imperial power, although very underdeveloped, spanning Asia, mainly Asia, as well as Europe. And obviously, at least one of the critiques of imperialism was to come later out of Russia. He ends up, Kotoku, engaging with the ideas of the anarchist writer Peter Kropotkin. How did that kind of contact take place? In the case of Kropotkin, it was a significant enough encounter in terms of ideas that Kotoku actually moved from socialism to anarchism.
Yeah, this happens, the relationship with anarchism is interesting. This happened sort of after later in the Russo-Japanese War, the government finally decides, particularly after the publication of Marx, to close down the newspaper, and it launches a trial against the editors of the newspaper and puts Kotoku Shusui in jail for a period of about 6 months. It's during that time that he first reads Kropotkin. And this has a big influence on him. And then not too long after that, he goes to San Francisco and spends, actually he's in San Francisco, I think, right around the time of the San Francisco earthquake, which he writes an article about and says that this was kind of showed that government is not necessary. It disorganizes all of society, but it shows that society can exist autonomously of the government, the earthquake. So this is, in some ways, a kind of realization of anarchism. He runs into various groups in San Francisco, including Japanese radical groups, Russian social revolutionaries, and becomes closer to kind of anarchist movements. And so that when he goes back to Japan about a year later, there's a change of government in Japan to a more democratic government, and he can come back and again work as a journalist in Japan. I think then he starts to favor direct action and kind of Kropotkin-like ideas, and he also translates some of Kropotkin's major works into Japanese. The Conquest of Bread, for example, he translates that. And so he's the first translator of Kropotkin into Japanese. He discovers Kropotkin in English.
So these are translations from Russian to English and then English to Japanese?
Most likely from, yes, I believe, and the same is true with Karl Marx. He translates the English translation of the Communist Manifesto rather than the German. So I think this is one of the interesting things, the often English at this time, because it was such a dominant language, is the vehicle for translating other languages into Japanese, because writers were more likely to be familiar with, I think this is how writers like Tolstoy or Dostoevsky are translated into Japanese. It's through someone's reading their works in English translation. So in any case, this is how Kropotkin also at this time lives in London. He's in exile. And Kotokushusui writes to Kropotkin. He exchanges correspondence with him. And just as he also writes to Tolstoy, and while this is one of the interesting things, and I think it's one of the more meaningful things about his newspaper and the movement, which is called a heimin. Heimin means the common people, and it's a kind of term that is used only after the Japanese society changes from the feudal period, in which you're either a samurai, peasant, artisan, merchant, you're in one caste or another. But after the imperial restoration, most Japanese become heimin, so they become ordinary people. And the way Kotokushusui uses this term is to argue that the heimin of Japan are no different from the heimin of Russia. And therefore, the war between them is not really, the war between the two countries has nothing to do with the ordinary people of these countries. It's a war which is being waged by imperialists, by industrialists, financiers, groups like that. But it will not only bring no benefit to the ordinary people of Japan, but it will result in more hardship for them.
Robert Tierney is my guest. He is the author of Monster of the 20th Century, Kotoku Shisui and Japan's First Anti-Imperialist Movement, which is published by the University of California Press. We're discussing that book today, and you're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I wonder if you could tell us about some of the divisions that emerge within the anti-imperialist and radical movements in Japan. Kotoku had moved from socialism to anarchism. There were a whole number of debates about tactics. What were those about?
Yeah, I think that one of the things that we can say at this point is that when Kotoku makes a decision to support anarchism, this results in a real break with the previous Socialist Party. And this continues for a long time after that. So you have an anarchist movement, and then you have a communist party. At this point, there's no communist party in Japan. And so this lasts really all the way till the 1940s. And I think one of the big difference is that Kotokushusui was also saying that we should not just rely on parliamentary power. He was arguing that workers, for example, by strikes or by sometimes by violence, should try to change the situation directly rather than go through representative institutions. And one of the reasons for that was that he realized, I think, that the Japanese government could and later did restrict representative institutions if they threatened what were seen as national interests. So that's one big division. Another sort of a tension that you can see in Kotokushusui, even though he's opposed to Japanese expansion and sees it as a bad thing for the Japanese people, and only benefiting a few in Japanese society, he does not have a strong sense of solidarity with colonized people. So, for example, there's very, although he did have ties with Chinese intellectuals and tried to set up an organization, a kind of Asian solidarity movement, which would be opposed to Japanese imperialism, there are efforts toward that, but there's no really clear contacts that he had with people opposing Japanese imperialism who were sort of on the receiving end of Japanese imperialism. And I'm thinking particularly of Taiwanese and Koreans. So he did not, he was not really involved with those people. And probably ideologically, he would have found it difficult to do so because most of the anti-imperialist movement was based on a kind of nationalism, and he was opposed to nationalism. He saw patriotism as an evil, something that would give rise to imperialism. So I think one of the things that you can say about this, and I think it's later inherited by left-wing movements in Japan, is a kind of denigration of maybe nationalism, and including even anti-imperialist nationalism. So that later on, when you do have an organized communist movement, they are certainly concerned, they're opposed to Japanese imperialism, but that said, they see the Korean people as an exploited proletariat, not as people whose nation has been colonized by Japan. And I think they see nationalism as a kind of barrier to the awakening of kind of anti-capitalist awareness. I think that's one of the things that happens later in Japan. Now, this is not something that happens during Kotoku Shusui's life. This is really, we're dealing with something that happens like after World War I, I think, and after the development of a big anti-imperialist movement within Korea, within Taiwan, within the Japanese colonies. I think there's a kind of tension between the Japanese left and with anti-imperialist left in other Asian countries that continues.
Well, we don't have much time left. I would like, though, to ask you about the circumstances under which Kotoku was executed. And then I also would like to ask you about the degree to which his ideas are influential in Japan today. So war has been constitutionally outlawed in Japan since 1947. And
yes,
yet, right now in Japan, you've got a prime minister who's bent on militarization. So are these ideas known today? Are they influential today? Pushing two questions together in the interest of time.
Let me briefly, just there's an incident in Japanese history, 1911, the year he's executed. It's called the high treason case, or the high treason incident. And this is an alleged plot on the life of the emperor, in which basically the government makes a kind of dragnet in which they go around arresting everyone associated with kind of socialist anarchist movements and trying to link them with a plot. Now, there is a germ of truth in this plot, but it's blown out of all proportion. And in the end, I think the government uses this trial, it's a kind of show trial, to eliminate socialists and anarchists from Japanese society. So there's 20 are condemned to death, 11 are actually executed, including Kotoku Shusui, who's seen as the intellectual, the mastermind of all this. This is something that casts a pall on the left in Japan, that it will take several years for them to recover from. And then later, there are changes in Japanese society, and there's a kind of rebirth of this anti-capitalist movement. However, Kotoku Shusui, after that, until 1945, there was actually no way to actually study what had happened during this trial. I think that the government had complete control over the media and of the information that was disseminated. And as a result, Kotoku Shusui is seen as a traitor until after the war, when post-war intellectuals rediscover him and begin to publish his works and even his complete works, which happens very shortly after the war. And then he is seen as an important predecessor of the Japan's pacifist movement. So very closely connected with the peace constitution, that movement sees themselves as one of the inheritors. I mean, there's also an anarchist movement that inherits some of the ideas of Kotoku Shusui, but I think that's one of the ways that his legacy continues into the present. And I think actually it's only recently in Japan that, for example, the people that were condemned in the trial, the high treason trial, or were executed, have actually sought redress. For example, some of them were Buddhist priests, and they were excommunicated from their organization. And only later, you know, in the 90s or even in the last decade or so, have the religious sects that they were affiliated with apologized for the treatment of these people. Because there's a general recognition that this was a show trial, this was using the idea of terrorism to destroy, you know, portray Kotoku as an enemy of the Japanese people, rather than to, you know, look at his actual accomplishments. And I think that is one of the things that has shaped the legacy of Kotoku Shusui, so that even now in Japanese society, while there has been a revision of history, his association with the high treason event is still something that continues to exist. It's impossible to imagine the Japanese government building monuments to Kotoku Shusui. He's seen as too radical, too explosive a figure for them to be doing this, even though he's a very, very important central intellectual in Japanese society. And I think the critique that he makes of nationalism in particular is something that still resonates with Japanese today. There's a skepticism about nationalism that came from Japan's what had happened during the war and then the whole post-war period. And so that many Japanese intellectuals, you know, they didn't want to see the Japanese flag. They didn't want to sing the Japanese anthem. I think this is a very, very important psychological effect of Kotoku Shusui, that this, and of course the defeat in the war, a critique of nationalism in Japanese society. And I think that this is something that even under Prime Minister Abe and all the talk about changing the Japanese constitution, there's a strong opposition to this that comes out of the post-war peace movement. So while I think he has certainly made a lot of smaller changes, it may be rather difficult to change the Japanese constitution given the strength of pacifist sentiment in Japanese society.
We are completely out of time. I've been speaking with the author of Monster of the 20th Century, Kotoku Shusui and Japan's First Anti-Imperialist Movement. That's published by the University of California Press, and its author is Robert Tierney. He is Associate Professor and Head of East Asian Languages and Cultures, Comparative and World Literatures at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. And I should say that in Monster of the 20th Century, part of the book is Tierney's translation of Kotoku Shusui's text Imperialism, which we've been talking about in this hour. Robert, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you very much for having me.
You've been listening to Against the Grain. My name is Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.